So imagine you are the CEO of a massive corporation. You're trying to launch this new visionary product that's going to just fundamentally change your industry.
Right, a really high stakes situation.
Exactly. You have the mandate, you've got the capital, and you have the vision. But every single time you sit down to map out the big picture strategy, your phone rings.
Let me guess, someone asking for a bathroom key.
Basically, you are constantly interrupted because you personally have to approve every single employee's vacation request.
Oh, wow, that would be completely unmanageable.
Right. You have to sign off on every minor disciplinary hearing for staff you've, like, never even met. You have to personally approve a mid-level manager's transfer to a different floor in a totally different building.
You'd never get any actual strategic work done.
It sounds absurd. You'd never be able to actually lead the company.
Yeah.
But that bogged-down, micromanaging CEO dynamic is essentially the exact crisis South Africa is trying to solve with its government machinery right now. Welcome to the deep dive.
It's a massive undertaking, really.
It is. Today, we're analyzing the Republic of South Africa's Public Service Amendment Bill 2023. And our sources for this are the official legal text of the bill itself, along with the detailed explanatory memorandum that's attached to it.
Which I have to say, to anyone looking from the outside, a stack of legislative amendments like this usually just looks like an impenetrable wall of legal jargon.
Oh, completely. It's a tough read.
It really is. It's incredibly easy to see a dense document full of references to, Section 37 and Clause 14, and just immediately let your eyes glaze over.
Yeah, but our mission today is to translate that dense legal document into what it actually represents. It's a fascinating blueprint of how a massive national bureaucracy is attempting to, like, rewire its own engine.
It's a great analogy. It's like trying to swap out the concrete foundation of a skyscraper while thousands of employees are still actively working in the offices above.
Yes, we are looking at a government trying to fundamentally separate the politics of leadership from the paperwork of administration.
Okay,
So it's
let's
simple.
do it.
We need to start with the great delineation of power that's happening at the core of this bill. The text constantly refers to these two main players in the government ecosystem, right? The executive authority and the head of department.
Right, and that is the foundational split driving this entire legislative overhaul. Clause one of the bill clearly defines these roles, and you really have to understand the distinction to grasp what the government is trying to achieve here.
So break that down for us. What exactly is an executive authority?
So, an executive authority represents the political leadership of the state. We are talking about the president, a cabinet minister who heads a national department, or a premier heading a provincial office.
Okay, so the elected officials.
Exactly. The elected officials are the individuals appointed directly by elected officials. Their primary function is to drive a specific political mandate.
Got it. And on the other side,
On the other side of the equation, you have the head of department, or the Hodige. Now, this person is the top administrative civil servant in that specific department. They are the career bureaucrat, the operational manager.
and previously, the legal lines separating those two roles were just incredibly blurred, weren't they? Like, the political leader and the administrative manager were just stepping on each other's toes constantly.
Oh, constantly. Historically, the executive authority, let's use a cabinet minister as our example here, they held an enormous amount of direct, granular administrative power over their department's human resources.
Which goes back to that bogged-down CEO analogy.
Precisely. But under the amended Section 3 and Section 7(3) of this new bill, ministers and premiers are officially losing the statutory power to handle day-to-day administration.
Wait, officially losing it.
Yes, they are being structurally stripped of their direct authority over internal HR matters, staff appointments, routine transfers, and even internal disciplinary procedures.
So if I'm a cabinet minister, I am entirely locked out of the daily HR machinery. I can no longer reach down into the administrative ranks and personally hire or fire someone in my own department.
You are locked out. Under the new framework, your focus as an executive authority is purely on the macro level. Ministers are now statutorily responsible for approving the strategic plan of the department based on its core legislative mandate.
Okay, so they set the political vision.
Right. They set the vision, and the head of department, the HOPD, is now solely responsible for efficient administration, resource management, and the actual execution of that strategic plan.
The HOD manages the people while the minister manages the policy.
That is the exact split.
Okay, I have to push back here because this introduces a massive structural risk, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We're giving unelected career bureaucrats basically unchecked power to hire, fire, and manage the entire workforce of a government department.
It definitely sounds risky on paper.
Right. What happens if an OD simply refuses to do their job? Or worse, what if they deliberately stall a minister's agenda by, I don't know, refusing to allocate the right staff to a crucial project?
That's a very real concern.
If the elected minister cannot fire the staff beneath the ODD to force compliance, how do they actually exert control over their own department to deliver on the promises they made to the voters?
Well, the drafters of the bill actually anticipated that exact operational bottleneck. The legislation doesn't just leave the political leadership entirely toothless against a rogue or incompetent administrator.
Okay, so there's a backup plan.
Yes, it builds in a highly specific mechanism for checks and balances. Under the newly added Section 3.9, if an ODD refuses or fails to fulfill a power or duty required by the act, the executive authority has the legal right to intervene.
But they can't just fire them on the spot.
No, they can't just yell at the OD in a hallway or fire them immediately. The minister must issue a formal written instruction to the OD. And that instruction must specifically describe the administrative failure and state the exact steps required to rectify it.
Okay, so it forces a strict paper trail. It elevates a standard workplace dispute into a documented executive order.
Exactly. And if the HUSD continues to fail to take those documented steps, the minister then has the statutory power to report that failure directly to the president or the premier, depending on the level of government, for further action.
Wow, going straight to the top.
Right. And what's fascinating here is how this restructuring directly aligns financial accountability with human resources control.
How so?
Well, the bill explicitly links the HUSD role with the role of the accounting officer under the Public Finance Management Act. Previously, you had this disjointed reality where a minister might force a costly employment decision, but the HUSD, as the accounting officer, was legally the one left holding the bag for the budgetary consequences.
Oh, that sounds like a nightmare for the HUSD.
It was. By vesting all administrative powers with the HODIs, the person legally responsible for balancing the budget is finally the exact same person making the financial commitments regarding hiring and firing.
Aligning the financial risk with a hiring power makes total sense from a corporate governance perspective. But, you know, giving an administrative HOD that much localized power fundamentally alters the daily grind for the average public servant.
Oh, absolutely. It's a sea change for them.
If I am an employee in one of these departments, my entire career trajectory just shifted from a distant revolving door politician to the permanent manager sitting down the hall.
It drastically localizes the power dynamics within the public service, and the bill gets surprisingly granular about the tools it hands over to these HODIs.
Like what are we looking at?
Let's look at sections 9 and 17. The HOD now holds the absolute vested power to appoint staff in their department. They are the ones who confirm an employee's probation under Section 13. And critically, they hold the power to dismiss employees, strictly in accordance with the Labor Relations Act, of course.
So what does this all mean for the operational speed of the government? Because if we look at the explanatory memorandum, the driving force behind all these granular amendments is the National Development Plan 2030, right? The NDP?
Yes. The NDP is the guiding star here.
And the NDP identified that centralizing routine HR decisions at the ministerial level creates this crippling bureaucratic bottleneck. By shifting these approvals down to the HODs, the state is attempting to drastically increase the velocity of its decision making.
That's the goal, velocity.
And this velocity push touches every stage of a worker's life cycle, including retirement, right?
Yes. Section 16 deals explicitly with retirement. In the South African public service, normal retirement age is 65, but an employee retains the right to retire at 55.
Okay, a 10-year window.
Right. And the bureaucratic friction traditionally occurred in that gap between 55 and 60. If an employee wanted to execute that early retirement, it often required the executive authority sign-off.
Oh, man. So it could just sit on a minister's desk for months.
Exactly. Gathering dust. The amended Section 16 officially transfers the power to approve that early retirement directly to the HALD.
Well, that removes a major administrative logjam. But the bill also introduces tools that act as a sharp stick, not just a carrot, right? Like Section 16B amends the rules around resignations during a disciplinary hearing.
Yes, and this is clearly targeting a very specific vulnerability in employment law that bad actors exploit all the time.
Right.
The amendment to Section 16B states that if an employee is facing a formal disciplinary hearing, the Hochidi is strictly prohibited from agreeing to a shortened notice period for their resignation.
Oh, I see. This prevents that classic maneuver where an employee sees the writing on the wall regarding a major misconduct charge,
yeah,
and they just immediately tender their resignation to avoid the formal finding.
Exactly. They try to quit before they can be fired.
Right. So by forcing the employee to serve out their full notice period, the department ensures the disciplinary hearing actually concludes, placing that misconduct permanently on the employee's record.
Bingo. They cannot just slip away with a clean slate and get hired by a completely different government department a month later. It closes an escape hatch that has historically really undermined accountability across the public sector.
That's huge.
It is. But perhaps the most aggressive tool addressing bureaucratic stagnation is found in Section 30, which governs outside remunerative work.
The rules around side hustles.
Exactly.
So a public servant cannot engage in outside paid work without written permission, which is standard across most employment contracts, you know, to prevent conflicts of interest. The employee has to submit a formal request to the Hochidi.
Right, but the amendment introduces a ticking clock to this process that is genuinely radical for a government bureaucracy.
A ticking clock.
Yes. The Hochidi has exactly 30 days to make a decision after receiving the request. And if the Hochidi fails to make a decision within those 30 days, permission is automatically deemed to be granted.
Wait, really? Think about your own boss, everyone listening.
Yeah.
How would the dynamic change if they had a strict 30-day clock to approve your side hustle, or else you just get to do it automatically?
It's wild, right? The legal concept of deemed approval is a massive administrative forcing function. It completely flips the burden of bureaucratic inertia.
Because usually, no answer means no.
Exactly. In a traditional system, if management ignores a request, the employee is paralyzed. The lack of an answer acts as a de facto denial.
Yeah.
But by introducing deemed approval, the legislation penalizes management for inaction. If the Hochidi cannot organize their administrative machinery efficiently enough to process a simple request in 30 days, the employee is legally protected to proceed with their outside business.
Wow. It forces the administration to either function efficiently or just get out of the way.
That's the essence of it, yeah.
But this brings us directly to, like, the most glaring structural vulnerability in this entire redesign system. We've established that Hochidis now hold the keys to the entire government workforce. They hold the hiring power, the disciplinary power, and the budgetary power.
They hold all the cards.
Right. So here's where it gets really interesting. What happens if that massively powerful Hochidi is a highly partisan political operator? If the state takes power away from the elected minister specifically to prevent political interference in the civil service, but the Hochidi themselves is, I don't know, secretly running the local branch of a political party, the legislation hasn't solved the problem at all. It has just moved the partisan interference down one floor.
And that exact vulnerability is the primary target of Clause 16 of the bill, which introduces a brand new section into the Public Service Act, Section 36A. It's aptly titled Limitation of Political Rights.
Okay, so this is the firewall.
Yes, this is the core structural element of the political firewall the government is trying to build here. Section 36A strictly prohibits heads of department and, crucially, any employee who directly reports to an Hochidi from holding what the bill legally defines as political office in a political party.
And any type of office.
Any type. It specifies that this prohibition applies regardless of whether the political office is held in a permanent, temporary, or even just an acting capacity.
Well, the definition of political office is the linchpin here, isn't it? Because holding a political office could mean anything from being the national president of the ruling party to just being the person who manages the social media accounts for a local ward candidate. How wide is the net they are actually casting?
It's wide, but the drafters were very precise to avoid constitutional overreach. The bill explicitly defines political office as holding the position of chairperson, deputy chairperson, secretary, deputy secretary, or treasurer of a political party.
Okay, so the real leadership roles.
Exactly. And this prohibition applies across all geographic levels, whether that role is at the national tier, the provincial tier, or even down to a local regional branch.
Got it.
If you occupy the strategic decision-making echelon of a political party, you are legally disqualified from serving as an Hochidi or as a direct report to an Hochidi.
It's the equivalent of a referee in a professional sports match. Like, A referee is a citizen. They can privately support a team. They can buy a team's merchandise, and they can cheer for them on their day off.
Sure.
But they absolutely cannot sit on the board of directors for one of those teams while they are actively blowing the whistle on the field. The inherent conflict of interest just compromises the integrity of the entire game.
That's a perfect way to look at it. And the explanatory memorandum leans heavily into this exact logic. And the text is highly careful to clarify the boundaries of this limitation, too.
Because you can't just strip away people's rights.
Right. Subsection 3 of Section 36A explicitly states that this prohibition does not strip these senior civil servants of their fundamental constitutional rights under Section 19.
Which guarantees political participation.
Exactly. They retain the absolute right to vote, to hold private political beliefs, and to exercise standard political rights. They simply cannot operate as party bosses while simultaneously controlling the administrative machinery of the state.
But the transition logistics for this must be an absolute nightmare. I mean, there are undoubtedly current Hadis sitting in government right now who simultaneously serve as party treasurers or regional chairpersons.
Oh, without a doubt.
So the day this bill is signed into law, are they immediately in violation of the Public Service Act? Are they just fired?
No, the legislation provides a pragmatic runway for implementation. The bill stipulates a one-year grace period.
Okay, 1 year.
Right. From the moment Section 36A commences, any public servant currently caught in that dual role has exactly 1 year to comply. They are forced to make a definitive career choice.
Pick a lane.
Exactly. They can either retain their lucrative, powerful civil service position, or they can maintain their political party leadership role. They can no longer do both. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the ultimate manifestation of the National Development Plan's vision for a professionalized, nonpartisan state apparatus.
Which is the whole goal here.
Exactly. The explanatory memorandum emphasizes that separating the political sphere from the administrative sphere is absolutely essential to prevent the civil service from being weaponized for party politics, particularly during, you know, election cycles or changes in government administration.
So we have a system where the ministers step back and focus entirely on the grand vision. The Hadis step up, grab the absolute administrative reins of their departments, and formally drop all their political party leadership titles.
Right, a clean break.
But mapping this out conceptually leaves a glaring void at the very apex of the state structure. You now have dozens of individual national departments. Health, education, transport, public works, operating as highly independent, professionally managed silos under the command of incredibly powerful, nonpartisan Hadis.
Yes.
Who is acting as the conductor of this massive bureaucratic orchestra, who ensures that the Department of Transport's administrative goals aren't directly conflicting with the Department of Public Works' administrative goals.
That's the million-dollar question. And Clause 4 of the bill addresses that exact apex coordination problem. It amends Section 7 to drastically elevate a very specific role, the Director General in the presidency.
The DG in the presidency.
Yes. The NDP originally envisioned the necessary creation of an administrative head of the public service. This legislative amendment officially designates the presidency's DG as that supreme administrative head.
Wait, let's clarify the authority dynamics here for the listener. Does this amendment effectively turn the DG in the presidency into a sort of super who? Like, can the DG reach into the Department of Health and overrule that department's hood on a specific hiring decision?
No, and that is a crucial distinction to make. The DG in the presidency does not become an HR micromanager for the entire government.
Okay, so no super veto power over HR.
Correct. The individual Hadis remain strictly accountable to their specific executive authorities for delivering their department's strategic mandate. The DG in the presidency's elevated role is focused entirely on macro-level coordination, not micro-level administration.
So what are the actual statutory mechanics of that coordination then? What do they actually do?
Well, the bill formally mandates the head of the presidency as the secretary to the cabinet. Beyond that, this DG is legally tasked to convene and chair the Forum of South African Directors General, which acts as the central coordinating body for all national Hadis.
Ah, so getting everyone in the same room.
Exactly. And crucially, the legislation makes the DG responsible for intergovernmental relations on an administrative level. In a system like South Africa's, where national and provincial departments share concurrent competencies, having a single administrative head is vital.
To make sure they're actually talking to each other.
Yes, to ensure that legislation, strategic planning, and operational execution are aligned across all spheres of government.
So they ensure that the massive machinery of the state is actually rowing in the same direction to support the president's overall mandate without interfering in the localized HR decisions of individual departments.
Perfectly summarized.
Now, we spent a lot of time analyzing how this bill reorganizes the massive macro-level power dynamics at the very top of the government structure. But what fascinates me is how the legislation simultaneously reaches all the way down to correct a past wrong regarding the most sensitive, immediate issue for an everyday public servant.
Their paycheck.
Clause 18 of the bill executes a critical pivot from macro governance down to fundamental labor rights. It amends Section 38, which dictates the legal protocol for when the government accidentally overpays an employee or grants them a financial benefit they were not legally entitled to receive.
Right. And administrative errors happen in any payroll system, especially one managing hundreds of thousands of employees.
Of course. But under the old rules, the state had an incredibly heavy-handed method for fixing its own mistakes, didn't it?
It really did. The previous provision granted the state unilateral power of recovery. If an accounting officer realized the department had overpaid an employee, the state could simply recover that money by deducting it directly from the employee's future salary.
Without asking.
There was no requirement for a court order, no mandatory negotiation period, and no requirement for the employee's consent. The state made an error, and the state unilaterally reached right into the worker's next paycheck to fix it.
To anyone operating in the private sector, that sounds like a blatant violation of basic employment law. You cannot just garnish an employee's wages without due process.
And the Constitutional Court of South Africa entirely agreed with that assessment.
Yeah.
The explanatory memorandum specifically cites a landmark legal defeat for the government, the case of Public Servants Association Obo Ubogu v. Head of the Department of Health, Gauteng.
The Ubogu case.
Yes. In that judgment, the Constitutional Court struck down the old provision, ruling that unilateral deductions by the state violated the Basic Conditions of Employment Act.
Makes sense.
The court basically established that the state, operating as an employer, does not possess special privileges to bypass the fundamental labor rights of its workforce.
So if we look at the amended Section 38, how does the government legally recover an overpayment today? Imagine a scenario where an administrative glitch results in an employee receiving double their salary for a month.
Well, the new statutory rule is incredibly rigid. The accounting officer must first formally seek the employee's consent, in writing, to make any deduction from their salary to recover the overpayment.
Wow. The state legally has to ask for permission to take the money back out of the payroll system?
They do.
Let's be realistic about human behavior here. If a mid-level worker accidentally receives an extra 20,000 rand, there is a very high probability that money is immediately spent on rent, debt, or groceries before the department even notices the error.
Oh, almost certainly.
Right. So if the state asks for written consent to deduct the money, and the employee simply refuses because they literally cannot afford the deduction, what is the administration's recourse?
If the employee refuses to provide written consent, the department's administrative hands are completely tied. They cannot unilaterally touch the employee's salary. To recover the funds, the state is now legally forced to initiate formal legal proceedings against the employee.
Like take him to court.
Yes. And the bill is exhaustive in applying this principle. Even if the overpaid employee resigns and leaves the department entirely or transfers to a completely different provincial department, the state can attempt to recover the debt from other funds owed to the individual, such as a pension payout or their new salary at the different department. But the exact same legal threshold applies. The state still requires the individual's written consent, or it must secure a court order. This actually raises an important question regarding the inherent tension in public administration.
How so?
On one side of the scale, you have the fiduciary duty of the state. This is taxpayer money. If an administrative error results in public funds being misallocated, the accounting officer has a legal and moral obligation to recover that capital.
Sure.
But on the other side of the scale, you have the severe economic reality of the working class.
Yeah, a sudden unilateral deduction to recover a massive overpayment could easily reduce a worker's monthly take-home pay to zero. That immediately cascades into an inability to feed a family, pay a mortgage, or cover basic transportation costs to even get to work that month.
Exactly. The Constitutional Court, and now this legislative amendment, definitively states that the state's need to recover taxpayer funds cannot supersede a citizen's right to administrative due process.
It is a profound micro-level correction buried inside a macro-level restructuring bill.
It really is.
So, To summarize the massive amount of legislative architecture we have explored today, the Public Service Amendment Bill of 2023 is a highly comprehensive, statutory attempt to build a literal firewall between political strategy and bureaucratic administration in South Africa.
That's the core mission.
It fundamentally strips daily HR meddling from the hands of politicians. It empowers career heads of department with the localized authority to actually run their departments efficiently. It legally restricts those OTs from holding political party office to ensure they remain neutral arbiters of state function.
And it sets up the coordination at the top.
Right. It elevates the presidency's director general to serve as the chief macro coordinator of this newly professionalized machinery. And, as we just discussed, it meticulously cleans up unconstitutional labor practices regarding employee pay deductions. It is a monumental shift in how a state operates.
Absolutely monumental.
I want you to think about your own workplace, or perhaps your local city council. How clearly defined are the legal lines between the individuals who are elected to set the grand visionary strategy and the individuals who actually hire the staff, approve the budgets, and manage the daily grind?
It's usually a lot messier than we like to admit.
It is. When those lines blur, accountability vanishes, and bureaucratic inertia takes over. This bill is South Africa's aggressive attempt to draw those lines in permanent statutory marker. But I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to mull over as you digest all of this.
Let's hear it.
The entire premise of this bill, heavily driven by the National Development Plan, is that a perfectly neutral, hyper-efficient, highly professionalized bureaucracy is the ultimate ideal for running country. You want a state machine that flawlessly and rapidly executes the will of the government without any partisan bias or administrative friction.
Right, that's the dream.
But if a nation successfully separates the political vision from the administrative execution, creating that flawless machine, what happens when a government's political vision is inherently flawed? Can a perfectly efficient bureaucracy executing a terrible, misguided policy without any friction, hesitation, or internal pushback actually be more dangerous to a country than an inefficient, bumbling one?
Hmm.
It is something to think about. Until next time.